let me see all your scars, came to pass among some black men when they found out another black man was from St. Louis. It was a way of kind of showing respect and all for any man who could survive that packing house city on the Mississippi River where Scott Joplin used to rag them long after the sun and moon went down. It was also a kind of badge that most black men from that city were expected to have, because it was almost universally understood that every black man that lived in and survived St. Louis had been cut at least once in their life. That was just the way it was, brother. But Charlie also remembered his father always saying that he wouldn't get caught dead without a gun after the lynching of his best friend T. Willie Delaney back in Red Earth, Georgia, back in 1913. Red Earth was on the outskirts of Dublin, and Willie Footman and T. Willie had worked the fields for the same white man, a certain Mr. Tom Barksdale. Charlie remembered all of this, and just before the tall, young black man with the shaggy fool tree of a beard began slowly squeezing the trigger of his .44. He had remembered his father saying that lynching of T. Willie was the final blow, the nail in the coffin. And so Willie Footman had bundled up his family of 13, including himself, his wife, his 8 sons and 3 in-laws, 2 nieces and 1 nephew, and moved on north to East St. Louis, Illinois, crossed from St. Louis, gateway to the west, former hotbed of ragtime music and Scott Joplin, and reputed cock of the Walk City on the Mississippi, where second-generation black sons and daughters that Abraham Lincoln had fired off the southern plantations, reeking of white men drunk on southern bells and sarsaparillas, peacocked around in white spats and frilly lace parasols, 3-piece suits and technicolored bonnets down by the Mississippi on easy strolling spring or summer Sundays, wore diamond rings big as hen eggs, legend had it, and where the cockiest young black ragtime styling bucks regularly beat the hell out of anyone, black, white, purple, crippled, green, or crazy, who had the complete misfortune to step across and encroach upon their invisible but highly noble line or sense of dignity and self-respect. At least this is the way legend had it. Back then, young black men in this packing house city by the river were known to kick asses, take names, and take no shit off anyone. But that was back in 1913, or perhaps even earlier, when Scott Joplin was still living there. Things had rapidly changed after the race riot of 1917. The lynching death of T. Willie had changed Willie Footman fundamentally and in the worst possible way. Not only would he never get caught dead without a gun now, he took to beating his wife and sons for the first time and for no apparent reason at all. Charlie thought of this as he focused in on that coldly staring .44 that somewhat reminded him of the eyes of a certain Doberman Pinscher that had attacked him once while he had been a mailman. Now he thought he could see the tree-bearded young man's eyes narrowing to cobra slits, the muscles in his upper jaw tightening. When Charlie saw this, he thought of the way he had felt when he first saw the body of T. Willie Delaney hanging up there, twisting and turning in the softest cotton. Silent, magnolia, Georgia evening breeze, crows and bats circling overhead, the crows caw-cawing in the dust of this distant filigreed memory, dreams flapping periods at the end of this macabre sentence. He remembered now, as he always remembered when something calamitous was about to happen to him, how his father, with tears storming his inconsolable angry eyes, muscles gripping and tightening in his cold dust colored square jaws, had taken them all out to see the body pitifully twisting up there in torn old work clothes. Mr. Delaney's pregnant wife was bawling and choking like some well-beaten young baby thing, thrashing around like some just-beached fish in the red dusk, beating her fists into the red earth beneath her husband's naked, turning feet that were tied together with a red bandana. He couldn't see it so vividly. He could always see it so vividly clear, as if it were only yesterday and not some 55 years ago when he was a spindly little boy of 6. But he was too young then to fully understand and know what he had been looking at the time. Still, he knew it had to be something bad because of the way Mrs. Delaney had been weeping and the horrifying, even then, and for one so young, sound of her weeping. He would never forget the sound of that, and the sad, the manner and style in which Mr. Delaney was hanging up there, silhouetted in the dusk fall, cotton soft, sweet magnolia, Georgia half-light, and the cawing crows and the circling bats banking in and out of the half-light. From all of this, he knew something was bad. He knew something was awfully wrong and all over a red sun. He remembered wondering almost out loud, why was Mr. Delaney turning around up there in that tree, his favorite tree, where he used to climb up and hide in when his mother was looking for him sometimes? And why didn't he just come on down? And he remembered wondering why Mr. Delaney's neck had been so twisted and tilted grotesquely to one side, and how his neck had looked like the broken necks of his cousin's rag dolls. He wondered why his father couldn't fix Mr. Delaney's neck like he fixed the necks of his cousin's rag dolls. And so he had asked his father just that. Why couldn't he fix Mr. Delaney's neck like he had those rag doll necks? And he never forgot the savage look that suddenly came into his father's red eyes, and just before he hit him with the hardest blow he had ever received. And even until this very day, when he was staring down the tunnel of that 44, he thought he had never, ever received another blow in his lifetime that was quite as hard. He had been knocked unconscious into the red Georgia dirt. And he didn't remember anything except seeing a million and one stars, it seemed, before the lights went out. And he woke up hours later with a headache so severe, he thought surely his head would up and burst. But that was why he came to associate wickedness and evil with the way Mr. Delaney's neck looked on that day. And why, after that day, and until he was old enough to understand the true meaning of broken necks, he came to the habit of associating his cousin's rag dolls with wickedness and evilness because of their always broken necks. So even when they were brand new dolls, that is why he got into the habit of always breaking their necks anyway and hiding them anywhere he could. Partly because of this feeling of wickedness and evilness, and also for reasons he never, ever fully understood, but that somehow he felt was because of the way his father had knocked him out on that day. So perhaps deep down, he thought he was getting even, perhaps an act of revenge, if you will. But this breaking of rag doll necks cost him the most severe whipping his usually passive mother, Mary, ever inflicted upon one of her boys. This happened one day when she caught him methodically and silently and with such obvious great pleasure breaking the neck of his cousin Annie Mae's new rag doll. He remembered being so terrified of the look in his mother's eyes that he had volunteered to show her on his own the hiding place for all of the other corpses of rag dolls whose necks he had broken. And after he had shown his mother all the rag dolls with broken necks and whose numbers added up to the number of years exactly 33 that Jesus had lived, and the great black poet Paul Laurence Dunbar, before they nailed him to the cross and into the minds of most people in the Western world, he remembered again how severely she had beaten him with tears in her soft brown eyes on that distant day, and how from that day on his brothers and cousins thought him to be a little bit strange, as did his mother and father. And now, as he looked down the barrel of that gun, trying to understand the mystery of his future, he was now the most powerful black man in the entire Show Me state of Missouri, able to give power and take it away with one snap of his diamond ring fingers, manicured and polished to the bone. Now he was trying as best he could to perhaps place the face of this tree-bearded young black man pointing this 44 at him. He could give life to some and take away the lives of others. He had been so long in power and had fought so hard and viciously to keep it. He knew that perhaps one day it might all end up in this manner. He even understood it, that was the way sometimes the cookie crumbled. And that was why his face showed no surprise nor any hint of fear or regret when he looked down the pit of that gun. And because he was a footman who knew exactly the kind of life he had led, the enemies he might have made, his round brown face with his thin mustache kind of knowingly flicked a gold-toothed half smile, as if to say he'd expected this visitor long before now. And when no one any longer thought him strange, he was raising his hand almost in a kind of half salute when the first shot rang out. Thank you. I brought about 20 books if anybody wanted any books. And we got them over there. Help the poet.
Thank you all for coming. I want to say one thing I forgot at the beginning. I was a little nervous. Robin Mack was ill this evening, and she couldn't come and read, and I was very disappointed. But I got a letter from her on Saturday that she couldn't come, so I appreciate you all being here. And I want to make one other announcement, which is that this evening, the proceeds from this evening's reading are going to establishing an Arthur Brown Poetry Prize, and we are going to be accepting poems between now and the beginning of April, and between April and May they will be read and judged, and then we will announce the winner at the last reading. So if you know any poets who are interested in this, the rules and regulations will be published probably in the next week or two, and we'll be publishing that at probably in the paper and passing them around and things like that and sending a mailing. So if you're interested in submitting poems, you can send them to the River Styx or the Big River Association. The address is 7420 Cornell. You can also probably drop we want 3 poems, no more than 3 poems. And you can also probably drop them off here, and Karen will get them to me. I hope she doesn't mind. But 7420 Cornell, 63130, St. Louis. So you can tell your friends. Thank you for coming. Oh, yeah, sorry. And the next reading is February 20th, and it's Jonathan Penner and Anna Lum. Jonathan Penner is a short story writer, and Anna Lum is a poet from St. Louis. And Jeff Noonan will be playing music. So hope to see you.